Both supporters and critics of the invasion of Iraq have been asking the same question recently. How could things have gone so wrong? A new documentary called No End in Sight is a systematic dissection of the Bush administration's Iraq policy decisions and their consequences, directed by Charles Ferguson. He's an MIT-trained political scientist and high-tech expert who's a member of both the Council on Foreign Relations and the Brookings Institute. The film, which won the Special Documentary Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival, opens today at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. And it gives me great pleasure now to welcome Mr. Ferguson to my show, along with Colonel Paul Hughes, who served as Director of Strategic Policy for the U.S. occupation in 2003. Hello.
Good day. Hello.
And let's begin with you, Colonel Hughes. How close were you to being killed on 9/11?
Pretty close.
You were in the Pentagon?
I was in the Pentagon and had just come back from my getting a haircut, of course. And I walked by my office where I always kept a little television on to CNN. And as I walked by, I saw one of the World Trade Center towers burning, or smoke coming out of it at the time. And so I gathered up my staff because we dealt with things related to air defense and missiles and stuff like that. And we just were interested in the story. And as we stood there in my little office watching this, we saw the second plane hit. At that time, there was not a doubt in my mind what was going on.
Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with it in your mind.
Oh, not at all. No. This was all Osama bin Laden at this point. So for about the next 15 or 20 minutes, people were crowded in the office watching and, going through the gnashing of teeth and whatnot. And I finally said, listen, people, the only thing you can do for your country today is just go back and do your duty. Go back to your desk, keep focused on the work that you have at hand and get it done. We cannot help New York City. There are a lot of other people who are out there trying to help them right now. And about 5 minutes after everybody left, I was talking with one of my civilian colleagues who was still stunned by it all. And then suddenly the entire place turned upside down. I knew right away we'd been hit by the weapon du jour.
And you were just on a floor that didn't get destroyed as others did.
Yeah, I was in the newly renovated part of the Pentagon on the third floor, and it wasn't until 4 days later when I was able to get back in and my boss showed me the map of where the plane had actually hit the Pentagon and penetrated it that I realized that plane went literally right under our section.
Now, Charles Ferguson, for this film you've assembled an impressive cast, including Secretary of State Colin Powell, his former Chief of Staff Lawrence Wilkerson, former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, retired General Jay Garner, who was the first coalition governor of Iraq, former Ambassador Barbara Bodine, many military, diplomatic, judicial, security specialists, and they all seem to agree on at least one thing, that the U.S. invasion of Iraq was ill-conceived from the start, especially when it came to long-term consequences. Did they know that from the start, or is that something that they learned along the way?
I think that many of them saw disturbing signs very early on. Many of them tried to warn the administration, but unfortunately the administration was not in a mood to listen.
And it was interesting how candid some of these people were. I guess they have no thoughts about going back into government, or at least not while the current administration is in power.
That I think that by appearing in my film as they do, they have guaranteed that they are not going to be in the Bush administration.
Did you ask Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz to participate?
Yes. We tried very hard to get all senior members of the administration, present and former, to participate in the film, but every single one of them declined. Jerry Bremer, L. Paul Bremer, the administrator of Iraq, initially said yes, but then backed out.
You make the point that a key moment in this story is when the president signed an order putting occupied Iraq under control of the Pentagon rather than the State Department. Why was that so important?
Well, I think it was important for two reasons. The first is that the Pentagon, while it has many useful skills and assets, is not in general the place where policy decisions regarding occupations are made or should be made. But in this case, I think even more important was who was running the Pentagon right now, namely Donald Rumsfeld.
Do you think it was because the president trusted him more or trusted Colin Powell less?
I can't get into the president's mind. All I can say is that it's extremely clear that during this period, the president was very passive and deferred to Vice President Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld to a remarkable degree.
Paul, before you went to Iraq, you were a senior military fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. Couldn't you apply what you knew in theory to what was happening on the ground in Iraq?
Well, we did try to apply what we had learned in a conference that I organized over the summer of 2002 and was actually held in the fall of 2002. I brought together a number of diplomatic, humanitarian assistance, international experts, and military experts to talk about the issue of managing a post-Saddam Iraq. A report was written, and it was given to the proper offices within the Department of Defense, to the Deputy Secretary, to the Joint Staff, and to other Secretary of Defense offices that had that purview. But in retrospect, not many of them tried to implement it. When I joined Jay Garner's office, I was one of the first people assigned to his office. The first thing I gave him was a copy of that report, and I can remember him coming to one of the early staff meetings with that report and saying, "This is our blueprint." So we tried to implement what all of these experts had collectively come together and thought best. But the condition in which ORHOP, the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, was created left us without a great deal of resources and understrengthed, and just we were the new kid on the block and nobody really wanted to listen.
And the film also makes the point that the State Department did a lot of thinking about what a post-Saddam Iraq would be like, but the actual planning for what was going to happen was instituted by the Pentagon less than 2 months before the invasion, I guess, when they realized that it was pretty much a sure thing. Charles, weren't you initially optimistic about the invasion? What led you to change your mind?
Well, I wouldn't say that I was optimistic about the invasion. I was favorably disposed, or at least I was sympathetic, I would say, to the idea that it might be necessary and justified to use military force to remove Saddam Hussein. I did see disturbing signs early on in the conduct of the Bush administration that made me worry that perhaps it was not going to be done as well as it needed to be done. But I really had not the faintest idea then of just how amazingly incompetently it was going to be managed.
The film is filled with lots of footage from Iraq, and most of the times there are fires one place or another. Did you shoot most of that footage?
Footage showing fires or violence, no, I didn't shoot personally. I spent a month in Iraq. I did shoot personally some of the footage that's in the film. Other members of my crew shot a lot of the rest. Luckily, however, nobody directly tried to kill us.
But it was pretty dangerous, I gather. You spent $7,000 a day on an armored Mercedes. You had a large Kurdish security detailed, armed with machine guns. You never went into the streets for more than 20 minutes, never to the same place twice. Is that the kind of advice people give you?
Yeah, it's definitely the kind of advice people give you. Yes, yeah.
Paul, do you think that it's gotten more dangerous over the past 4 years?
Oh, yeah. When I was there in 2003 and we watched the beginnings of the insurgency, we at that time could still go downtown. I had friends who would go visit art galleries and purchase art. Some of our team would go downtown for midday lunch, things like that. But now when I go back to Iraq, it's nothing like that now. You go into the international zone, what's commonly called the green zone, and it's like being in a rat maze of 18-foot-tall concrete walls.
What was your assignment when you went to Iraq right after the invasion?
Well, I went as part of Jay Garner's organization as the Director of Strategic Policy for the Office of Humanitarian Assistance and Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance. And then I stayed to help the transition to the Coalition Provisional Authority, where I performed the same duties.
To reorganize the Iraqi military, mostly?
Well, no. And at that particular point, my job was to help Ambassador Bremer get off on a good start. I mean, nobody wants to be on a team that's going to lose. So I was working feverishly to try and help him organize and staff.
But the film makes the point that mistake after mistake after mistake was made by Jerry Bremer, at least. He was the face on those mistakes.
Yeah.
And many feel that one of the first big mistakes was dissolving the Iraqi military and firing most of the Ba'athist bureaucracy. Do you agree?
Undoubtedly, those were two.
Did you tell Jerry Bremer that?
Well, I know that Jay Garner went and talked to him about these. And the response that Jay got from Bremer was, listen, I have my orders. I'm going to carry them out. And that was that.
So no matter what you would have said, it would have fallen on deaf ears because people had already made up their minds?
Absolutely. I mean, it was astonishing to both Jay and myself because neither one of us had been consulted about these proposed decisions. General McKiernan, who commanded the ground forces attacking Iraq, was never consulted, and he used to ask us, you know, when are you guys going to get the army stood back up? I need the army. None of us knew what was going on. And I guess, Leonard, the thing that was most shocking about this was the decision-making process that all of these men in Washington, D.C. knew and should have followed, and they consciously chose not to follow it.
Well, after the Iraqi military, the Republican Guard, and the secret police were disbanded, you had a half million armed men suddenly unemployed. It seems like anybody would have figured out that they were going to do something, An insurgency was a strong possibility. That was the beginning of people. That and the looting, I guess, was when Iraqis started changing their minds about whether this was a good idea.
There are a series of things. Yes, those were two of the largest. There were four or five major decisions early on that turned many Iraqis against the United States and I think doomed the occupation. Allowing the looting was certainly one. Instituting an official American occupation instead of restoring Iraqi sovereignty was a second. The de-Ba'athification order was a third. Disbanding the military was a fourth. Those were certainly disastrous decisions.
And then there were symbolic ones. Even though we didn't protect the cultural heritage of Iraq, we made sure that we secured the oil ministry, which led an awful lot of people to think that this invasion was really all about oil. Weapons were left open. And you say, Paul, that people were aware of this and that Iraqis were calling for for Americans to come in and do something, and that decisions were made specifically not to do them.
Yeah, well, the approach of the administration had been that this would not be an occupation. It would be the decapitation of a dictator, and then it would be handed over, the responsibility for governing would be handed over to an Iraqi authority of some personage. And, you know, I tend to believe that the Department of Defense had a specific name in mind. Chalabi, Ahmed Chalabi, and that we were going to get out of there as quickly as possible.
Is that why no martial law was declared at a time when it was obvious that things were becoming chaotic?
Exactly. You know, if you declare martial law, the only legal substance that you can use for declaring that is the Fourth Geneva Convention. And we chose not to undertake anything that related to responsibilities under the Fourth Geneva Convention because we weren't going to be an occupation power.
Now, Charles, you've taken us step by step through the decision-making process or the lack of decision-making process, and it is stunning. But one of the most stunning things, a running theme through this, are numerous clips of Donald Rumsfeld ridiculing reporters who were asking reasonable questions about the failures of the occupation, including his famous Henny Penny comment, which I think you included twice. Was Rumsfeld the problem or just the most prominent face of the problem, do you think?
He was a big fraction of the problem. His views seem to have been largely shared by Vice President Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Doug Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and Jerry Bremer, the Administrator of Iraq. Those four men seem to have made most of the important decisions about occupation policy.
Now, you have to tell me how this film even came about. You have no previous experience as a filmmaker, a doctorate in foreign affairs at MIT, but you really got into Silicon Valley and created the software company Vermeer Technologies, which I think has been rumored to have been sold to Microsoft for $133 million. So did that is that what paid for this, or was it the sales of your tell-all book, High Stakes, No Prisoners, A Winner's Tale of Greed and Glory in the Internet Wars?
Well, I do have a sordid past in Silicon Valley, but I've loved film for a long time and wanted to make films for a very long time, and was fortunate enough to become financially secure and
also hook up with Alex Gibney, who, because this film really does not look like a first film. But Alex says in the old days, the networks might have done this story. They're too chicken now. Did you feel that you had a responsibility to do it, finally tell the story step by step by step?
Yes, a responsibility and unfortunately also the opportunity, by which I mean that nobody else was doing it. And I have to say that I found it stunning, utterly surprising that as of 2005, when I started, nobody had made a serious film about the occupation of Iraq.
Well, there have been many films about Iraq, and many of them from soldiers' points of views and telling part of the story, but I don't think there's any one that's just gone step by step and talked to people like you, Paul. Did you feel frustrated? Did you feel that you wished somebody was asking you some of these questions? And do you think some of the other people who've talked in this film felt the same way?
I can't speak for others, Leonard, but I can tell you that when Charles first contacted me about participating in this project, I had my reservations. You know, there's a culture within the U.S. military that tells you that you don't participate in these kinds of exposés. And Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 had recently come out, and I was just thinking to myself, oh my God, I don't want to be part of a project that's going to ridicule soldiers or you know, demean the humanity that's being lost in Iraq. And I asked him for 24 hours, and he gave me 24 hours, and my daughter, who is an aspiring actress, gave me some feedback about him and said he's the real deal. And so I called and I said, yeah, I'll do it.
And this isn't gadget prompt. This is actually a pretty serious analysis.
Absolutely.
The film is called No End in Sight, and it opens today at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. And I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Colonel Paul Hughes and Charles Ferguson, who wrote, directed, produced, whatever else was necessary. Thank you both again.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.